Welcome to another episode of The Dirty Inning. Here to bring you...
Hello! All yeah, not so fun.
Roles.
Not no, so fun actually, on that side of it, is it?
Mm. It's really fun.
I have fun
I like it, and it's good. Welcome in the season. It's been a boring baseball season, huh? The Phillies aren't really all that entertaining. They're certainly not playing right now as we record in a close game against a division rival.
Nobody's talking about it. Everybody's just, it's Flyers mania as usual in Philadelphia. Oh boy. How about the orange and black, they say, on the subway?
Who will they bring in for their manager? What young players will they bring back? All the people are asking.
Who will people be mad that isn't the coach?
I know who that is. But anyway, it's Joel Quenneville. But I wanted to harken back to a previous time that, just to remove the facade, it's a very exciting time in Philly's baseball fandom life. They are off to a blistering start, even if they lose tonight, which I think they're still leading, so I don't know if they will or won't. But they are off to a great start, and actually, Justin, I don't know if you saw this, but when they won their first four games, that was their first opening four-game winning streak since...
I believe it was said 1915 was the last time they got off to such a hot start.
That's correct. The 1915 Phillies, who went to the World Series against the Boston Red Sox and lost, the last part isn't important, but it was their first World Series ever. It was a really sort of surprising and fun team, and they also started 4-0. They actually started 8-0.
Oh, man.
Eventually they...
Could have matched that 8-0, that sexy, on-fire 1915 Phillies team. And once again, the 2019 Phillies fall short.
Fall short of what I want them to do 104 years later. But no, it's a fun team. So I decided to take a look and see if they had any rough games. And as it turns out, their first loss was no fun. It turns out the first time they lost was on April 24th, 1915. They lost against the Boston Braves, who were at that point 5-5, but as we'll find in this episode, they were no slouch either. They had actually won the World Series the previous year in a season that actually we've talked about, in a team we've talked about too, I believe. And they finished second in the National League to the Phillies. But they lost this game 10-2. Now, I give you the final score ahead of time because this is not your traditional dirty inning. There was no inning in here that was particularly dirty. But in looking into all of these players, these teams, the situation they were in, the similarity and hype between it and the 2019 team, it really is a fascinating group of people. And it has a bunch of old favorites of ours. It's almost like a dirty inning all-stars. So wow. I'm excited to bring it to you.
I'm very curious already. Are we looking at... A 1915 team that full of names we remember.
Well, if you listen to this podcast, we sure are.
Guys like Beals Becker and Possum Witted.
You think Justin's making these names up, but those are two players.
An actual man named Bud Weiser.
That one's fake.
No, it's not. He was an outfielder and pinch hitter.
Oh, he wasn't. Wow, I didn't look into the actual team. I kept my search. I wanted to limit myself, so I only looked at this game. But that's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But some names you'll recognize from this, and I won't belabor them when we're actually talking. But Fred Luteris, we've talked about on the show. Bill Kilifer, we had a whole episode on, basically.
We did. I feel like Gavi Kravath is another name that's come up before.
If it has, we haven't spent nearly enough time on him. I don't want to spoil it for everyone, but we're going to talk a lot about Gavi Kravath.
Oh, boy.
Dave Bancroft is on the Phillies Hall of Fame, I believe. No, he's not, but he was a Hall of Famer that they acquired the season ahead of time. And on the Braves, there's Rabbit Moranville, who we've all heard of. There is Sherry McGee, who is on the Phillies Wall of Fame, but is playing for the Braves in this game. It really is like a fairly star-studded affair in terms of, again, if you listen to this podcast and know these names.
All your old favorites are there.
Oh, David Paskert's on here, too.
Yeah, names like Epa Rixey and Ben Tincup.
Epa Rixey's a Hall of Famer.
I know. We also covered some ground with him. Boy, it's really been a crazy... We should really start putting the episode numbers in the titles the way other more professional podcasts do, because then we would know what episode we're at. It has been years since we started this podcast.
It's really strange. Yeah, we've covered a lot of ground. It feels like every night we do it, it's our first episode, which is why it's so fresh.
And a decent amount of overlap. When you consider that it's been over 100 years of the Phillies losing baseball games in their good and bad seasons, and yet somehow we managed to overlap a decent amount.
It's so weird, though, because, like, and I'll get into the game after this because there's a lot to cover, but the it's so weird because the actual, like, biographies of these guys, where you actually look at, like, what they did and who they played for and stuff, almost to a man, they play either for the Phillies in 1915, the Braves, some of them end up playing for the Cubs, and then the rest of them play for the Giants. Wow. And it is like there are four teams in the National League.
I was going to say that. I was going to suggest the exact same thing. Yeah, maybe baseball just should have had more than six teams at this point in its history.
It's really strange. Like, it's very, very weird. And, I mean, some of this is because the teams, like, some of these teams failed, like the Pittsburgh Rebels, the St. Louis Terriers, the Brooklyn Tip Tops, and the Newark Pepper. The St. Louis Browns, of course, Baltimore Terrapins, Buffalo Blues.
These sound like Federal League teams, actually, now that I think about it.
The funny thing is, this is the year that the Federal League really created some havoc for these teams.
That's right.
1915, and we talked about this as well, when the Federal League came in and offered to pay people a lot more money. And you'll hear some funny stories about that. You really will.
Some wacky stories about players getting paid what they were worth.
Most of them don't.
Being able to live.
No. If you're hoping for
absolutely not. This man died of toxic lung syndrome.
There's our first person we're going to cover has a rough death, so I want to warn you already. But
this is that baseball podcast. Yeah, well, it is. This guy really died screaming.
Well, I don't want to go over what happened in 1915, because we all know it was the beginning of the war to end all wars, World War One, which
hasn't really been a war since. Checkmate, yep. History.
It really was a horrible war. When I grew up, when I was growing up, I don't know if you had this experience in history class. By the way, this is Justin Clue that I'm talking to. Is the
I was going to point out
of Grantland and the contributing editor at ESPN.
Hello, everyone. The Dirty Inning is a podcast in which we look at the most obscure, more hilarious, or forgotten innings in Phillies history.
It's been a while since I led one.
A more able host would have said that maybe within the first 60 seconds. But hey, as I've proven many times, there's no limit to what information we won't tell you when this podcast begins.
And I'm Trevor Strunk. I do a lot of things. I have a podcast called No Cartridge. I've written a baseball prospectus. And as Justin wants to point out every time we're on, I have a doctorate. I also have a fairly young child, so that's why I haven't been taking over a lot of these. But hopefully this will be the first of many.
People are sick of your excuses, frankly, Trevor.
Well, you are. In any case, the 1915 Phillies were really... There are two people I'm going to cover a lot of on this episode. And this is the first one, and this will probably take us to the first break. But... maybe not all that way, but close. This is a guy who managed the club, and like a lot of people, he was a player manager. So like a lot of people at this time, almost everyone at this time, he was a player manager. And as Daniel Levitt's article on Sabre points out, Pat Moran, the manager for the Phillies, was managing in an era when a manager's responsibilities often included both the duties of a modern skipper plus those of a general manager. So the 1915 Phillies were really built in a lot of ways by Moran, who himself was sort of like, he wasn't a great hitter. Like, he was okay at baseball, and he played a lot of it. But he played a lot for leagues we don't know much about. So he doesn't have, like, a lot of playing stats on, he has some, but, like, a lot of, like, he played for the Bean Eaters, and he played for the Boston Bean Eaters, and he played for the, I think he was going to play for a team in Montreal.
Other famous teams of the era, like the Boston Boat Scrubbers, Topeka Tortoise Sitters. That was a fad at the time of people sitting on large tortoises.
The Elmira Charcoal Stains. Mm-hmm, it's an important time. But he did play for the Cubs. I mean, he basically was like a reserve player. He wasn't, he was good. Like, he was decent. But he actually moved to Philadelphia, as this says, to help spell catcher and player manager Red Dewin, who suffered from a broken ankle. And actually, Horace Fogle, who was the president of the Phillies, who was ousted from the National League after the 1912 season for publicly and aggressively accusing the league and umpires of conspiring to throw the race to the New York Giants.
I'd like to hear more about this, please.
On another episode.
Wow. I mean, how serious? If he was that aggressive about it, he must have had some kind of evidence, right?
That's amazing. We should, you know what? Let's put a pin in that, because we should do like a hit and run just on that.
I agree.
That's an amazing thing to talk about. But Fogle really liked Moran. He actually pushed for him to stay there because, of course, Dewin was the regular manager, and Moran really fit in with the club great. Like he was secured for $2,500 by the Phils, basically they just recognized that he was smart, he was good with pitchers, and he was made sort of like the de facto pitching coach. And Dewin eventually became jealous, the article says, of Moran's expertise and reputation, and he looked to move him off the club, but Fogle recognized his talent and vetoed any action, and then aggressively attacked some umpires.
Boy, the game, I think part of the reason we dwell in these time periods of baseball is because such a different game. It's barely even baseball.
It's so good. It rocks. Like, I love all the player managers. Like, at one point, later on, he goes to... Moran goes to Cincinnati, and that's where he wins his lone World Series. But he's actually a very good manager. He has two pennants and a World Series in just under a decade of managing. But he went because Christy Mathewson was like sick. They just needed a player manager. Like,
jealousy, disease. These are the reasons you did or did not have a managing job in baseball in 1915.
It's so great. So I'm gonna go through a little bit of this in the article because I think it sets up this character quite well. So Fogle, the president who aggressively threatened umpires, gave Moran the credit for developing Grover Cleveland Alexander, one of the greatest hurlers of all time. Now, I don't know if you know this story, Justin. Even though we've definitely talked about Alexander on the show.
As they famously said in 1915, Trev, sock it to me.
They did say that. In the famous single of the time, sock it to me, sister, we're getting married again.
Sock it to me, sister, it's the World War again. ration yourself carefully.
Why are we calling this World War I? Do you think there's going to be another one? Fogle described how Alexander had a, quote, peculiar and non-effective delivery when he first showed up in spring training in 1911 after being drafted for $750.
Hot damn.
Roughly the cost of a PlayStation Pro in a couple of games.
That's a lot of beans. That's a lot of can of beans. Put me in first in line for the rations, please.
He gets to buy one giant steak in the house. Moran recognized Alexander's ability, however, and together with Earl Moore, converted Alexander to his famous sidearm motion. Phillies historian Dave M. Jordan corroborates Moran's early recognition of Alexander's ability. He writes that Dewin, the jealous manager, wanted to send Alexander back to the minors after a poor spring, but Moran convinced him to give him one final spring start. Alexander pitched well and made the club.
Wonder what he had on him that he could blackmail him into letting him do that.
I don't know. Dewin ends up very badly in this story. It's really good. And then next year, Eperixi joined the Phillies from the University of Virginia campus. And he just worked diligently, Moran did with Rixey, and Rixey actually credited him with much of his success. He said, "It was Pat who made a pitcher out of me, and I was fortunate to play with him under him, in both Philadelphia and Cincinnati. Few men that I've ever known in baseball knew the fine arts of pitching, as did Moran."
That's fascinating. But yeah. I got to be honest with you, given his deep insecurities, childlike jealousy, and general suckitude, I'm immediately obsessed with Dewin. He's now my favorite manager of all time, and I'm starting to realize I have a problem.
He's the Larry Boa of 1912 to 14. So Moran's really interesting. I had never heard of him, but he is basically the architect. He's sort of the Matt Klintak, even more sort of the Howie Roseman of the 1914 to 1915 Phillies. The 1914 Phillies were not as miraculous a turnaround as the 1914 Braves were, or the 1913 to 1914 Braves were, where the 1914 Braves were famously in last place in the National League, and then 2 months later they won the pennant. A turnaround that is like still historically incredible. The Phillies in 1914 were in sixth place, not good, and they were a pennant winner in 1915. And his deals were sort of like whatever at the time, but a year later they were deemed, quote, so successful they could be counted as once-in-a-lifetime affairs.
No kidding.
Yeah, so 2 weeks after Moran was hired, the Phillies purchased the contract of Dave Bancroft from Portland of the PCL.
Sure.
So he becomes a Hall of Famer. They just bought him. And then they removed Doohan as manager.
Bizarre move there. Okay.
And I'm going to, since you love Doohan so much, and I get why, I'm going to read you what happened to him.
What's his first name? Jimmy?
I don't even remember.
That doesn't matter. All right.
Doohan. What's his name? Hold on. We should probably figure out what his name is. It is Red Doohan. Of course, it's Red. Of course, everyone's name is Red.
Was he a little bit Irish? They called him Red.
Well, there's actually someone named Red Smith on the Boston Braves in this episode who his nickname was Red because he had red hair. So, I mean,
this is what I'm talking about.
Such a good time. So removing Doohan as manager raised the question of what to do with him, as he was still regarded as a valuable backup catcher. So this is the first season that Moran gets to be manager.
What is a valuable backup catcher? What is that?
I think in the teens you needed one because your catcher would sometimes just not be able to move because he was too concussed. So you needed someone to throw himself back.
What are you wearing those leg braces for? You're catching three games today.
Oh boy, if you like coming back quickly from injuries, you're going to really enjoy some of the stories. Moran first worked out a trade with Brooklyn manager Wilbert Robinson for George Cutshaw to fill the need at second base. Doohan did not want to report to Brooklyn and threatened to jump to the Federal League unless given a salary of $8,000 per year.
I'll be honest, when you said threatened to jump, I was like, oh boy, where's this going?
$8,000 per year is basically like, at this point, if Andrew Knapp was like, I won't report to the minors unless you pay me $7 million a year.
And Matt Glentek's like, I'll crunch the numbers, but there's absolutely no reason for me to do that.
Yeah, and as the Sabre bio says, not surprisingly, Brooklyn owner Charles Ebbets refused to pay this for a backup catcher. Although much of the salary demand was merely posturing, Doohan would have accepted less. The transaction never came together. I don't know how this writer knows this, but
he's really in their heads for being a historian.
Moran finally resolved the potential dilemma of having fired a fired ex-manager on the team, which is a dilemma, by trading Doohan to the Cincinnati Reds for starting first baseman Bert Niehoff, then astutely shifting Niehoff to second base. And then, so this is where it actually sort of gets a little more complicated. But I do want to say, this is why we don't have player managers, because if they lose the job, they're still on the team as a player.
I can see where you'd run into some problems there.
Sorry, we have to fire you, but show up for spring training for sure.
But don't be late for batting practice.
And be sure to respect the new manager, your former teammate.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Mm-hmm.
Another forced trade involved slugging outfielder Sherry McGee, who was on the Phillies Wall of Fame, as I've said. Very, very good player, who threatened to jump to the Federal League. So they had to trade him because he said, I'm going to jump to the Federal League. If you know, you're never going to see me again. He was described during the disappointing 1914 season as, quote, the quarrelsome captain of the shot-to-pieces Quakers.
Wow. I got to say, that's that's quite a critique. What a way to be remembered by history. That's like somebody in like 2059 being like, oh, yeah, we all remember those decimated fuck-to-death Philadelphia Phillies.
and their funny dictator, Gabe Kapler. So McGee had actually wanted to be named manager after Doohan's ouster, which makes sense because he was their best player. And so Moran shipped McGee to Boston for Oscar Doogie and George Possum Whitted, who is actually a pretty important player. We've talked about Possum on the show before. He's the one who was just like, I always confuse him with Robert Moranville, but he's kind of the same thing. He's all sort of like a funny guy.
Do we know where he got that nickname? We have to have talked
we
about that.
We do, but I can say it again. I have his Saber bio up. He got the nickname. There's a difference of opinion, but one source reported that he picked it up as a boy. No explanation there. Another said he got the nickname because of his tales of possum hunting in the woods around Durham.
I guess. I mean, this was an age where they were like, what's your hair color? That's your nickname. What animal did you stalk and kill as a child? That is nickname. What we will call you.
He also had the nickname Poffin Belly, which is a very good nickname.
Oh, well, that one explains itself. Please continue.
Well, I know we talked about this guy because this is the guy who fell out of a second story window at the age of 6 months without injury, was kicked by a mule, and the mule broke his own leg. And then he didn't want to go to school, and the school burned down.
Oh, that's right. And yeah, because he was like the son of Satan. Okay.
And he was the one who was blamed for messing around and having fun with Rabbit Moranville and Cotton Tierney and Charlie Grimm. They had a singing quartet, and that's why the Pirates didn't win the pennant in 21.
We all remember those youthful glory days of our baseball careers, starting fires with our minds and then going right to barbershop quartet practice.
I love the guys are just playing this video game in the clubhouse, and another player came in and broke the TV with a bat. And just fast forward, like rewind to 1915. It's like, you boys better stop your quartet, or we will win the pennant.
And they talked about it for months.
So that's really his Phillies career. But I wanted to touch on a couple things with the Reds before we jump to break. He went on to the Reds after the Phillies basically imploded. The owner at that point, Baker. Sold Grover Cleveland Alexander, and basically there was no team anymore, and so they were really bad in 1918, and then they fired Moran, which in the Saber bio they say Moran could not have been very disappointed because he was hired as the pitching coach for the Giants and then stolen away by the Reds with even a better offer to be their manager. And so they won the 1919 pennant, Reds did. And then they defeated the Chicago White Sox in the World Series 5-3. This is the Black Sox game, though.
Ah, yes.
It led to this funny encounter. So rumors flourished that gamblers had influenced the White Sox. And prior to the eighth game, Roush heard that gamblers may have manipulated some Red Sox players as well. So Roush is like the... Moran is, of course, the manager. Roush is the owner. So Roush went to Moran with his fears... the owner of the Reds, excuse me, and Moran confronted that day's starter, Hod Eller. Roush remembers the exchange as Moran called Eller over. Hod, I've been hearing rumors about sellouts. Not about you, not about anybody in particular, just rumors. I want to ask you a straight question, and I want a straight answer. Shoot, replied Hod. Has anybody offered you anything to throw this game? Yep, Hod said. And Roush recalled, you, quote, could have heard a pin drop. Eller continued, after breakfast this morning, a guy got on the elevator with me and got off at the same floor I did. He showed me $5,000 bills and said they were mine if I'd lose the game today. What did you say?
So what's going to happen?
I said if he didn't get damn far away from me real quick, he wouldn't know what hit him. And the same went if I ever saw him again. Moran decided to let Eller pitch, but told him, one wrong move and you're out of the game. And Eller started and won the game.
Wow. I mean, he had to be on the thinnest ice possible. We think, like, you know, somebody like Vince Velasquez tonight is on a short leash. You're looking at a guy who's like, not only may you just, you know,
not
go
well
through the ebb and flow of a natural pitching start and run into some trouble, but if you do, everyone's going to think that you have been compromised ethically.
You just admitted to the... Did anything happen to you? Yes.
Yeah, the craziest thing. I was going to tell you guys. A man got on the elevator and offered me $5,000.
Again.
Was that pertinent information to the World Series?
Why are you telling us? Shouldn't you tell the police? Oh, no, no, no. I told him I'd kill him if he ever talked to me.
I took care of it myself. What do I look like, a coward? Call on the police to deal with a criminal. Please.
And so Moran is, I think, the star of our show tonight, being the architect and skipper of this team. Even in a loss, I think he deserves some credit because he really took a team that should not have had any business being in the World Series and made them World Series, actually literally World Series contenders. And Moran was the player manager of the world of the maybe the first ever that I can think of where he says this is his philosophy, and we'll end with this: as leader, it is my business to give orders. and these are always carried out. Not by the mailed fist method, as I do not believe in that style, but as one friend to another. The players carry them out because they have confidence in me.
It's honestly, I remember this scene from A Few Good Men, where Kiefer Sutherland is explaining how strictly his rules are followed by his men.
Yep. And if you have confidence in us, you'll stay through the break, as we have to take a short gap to speak to our sponsors. Welcome back to the Dirty Inning. Justin, we've had enough manager talk. Let's get into this game. And by that,
finally,
I mean, let's talk about the players in the game.
During the break, all I did was scream at the top of my lungs that it was time to get to the players. So I'm glad to see you adhering to
you
that.
You just screamed that Red Doohan was done dirty. Where's Red Doohan's $8,000, you said?
I demand Red Doohan's $8,000.
I love that Red Doohan demanded the $8,000 and then later on clearly said to someone, I probably would have just like played there for not $8,000.
But that's also that's me screaming at a Phillies ticket representative on the phone.
Sir, we don't know who you're talking about or why.
You know.
So this game, like I said, was not particularly Dirty Inning-esque. This is a little different, but the third inning was not great. I can't even tell you about that because play-by-play data is not available for the 1915 season.
Interesting.
But really, it's death by paper cuts in a lot of ways. The Braves just scored one run in the first, three in the third, two in the fifth, one in the sixth, one in the seventh, and two in the ninth. And the Phillies had two home runs, one from Fred Luteris and one from Beals Becker. But ultimately, they just didn't have it that day. Now, the lopsided score makes me think this is a good game. The people make me know it's a good game. So what I've done is I'm going to go through each team. I have read their Saber bios, which is a trick I picked up from you. And because these older players don't have a lot of information, except in the Saber bios where truly admirable, insane people have researched these like role players extremely well, and sometimes for weird reasons. Like the one guy we'll look at was it extremely had like the most detailed bio I've ever seen, because the guy who wrote it was like coached by him in college and considered him a good friend and drove him into the hospital before he died. Like, just crazy, crazy dedication in ways that you'll never find anywhere else. So, wow. Saber, thank you so much for this. There are some that were not available on Saber. One of those people was the second baseman for the Boston Braves, and that's Ed Fitzpatrick. Ed Fitzpatrick is unfortunately not even on the Miracle Braves of 1914. He doesn't have anything interesting about him particularly. He played for 3 years. He hit one home run. He played, you know, four positions. He also pitched, as is, you know, fairly common in this era. He didn't pitch. Excuse me, I read that wrong. But he just is not super interesting. I will say, as one of the enemy combatants in this game, he was born in Lewiston, Pennsylvania, and died in Bethlehem. So, he was a Pennsylvania man at heart.
A local guy,
that's
sure.
Right. That's right.
He was just on the wrong, made a few bad decisions, wound up on the wrong team. You know, it happens to the best of us.
So he played second that today and got a hit. That's all I can tell you about him. And got two walks. He's sort of been forgotten to history. Herbert Moran, who I was so excited that he would be like Pat Moran's brother and on the Braves, but he was not. He is actually fairly interesting. So he was the right fielder for the Braves that day, and Herbert was part of the 1914 Miracle Braves, and basically he was there because he was fast. He wasn't like a lot of these guys. It turns out like people did not remember who they were, and so by the end of their career, they just like did not like no one knew who they were. They just died, and they were like, that old man played baseball. It literally is like the end of a movie.
I thought he was just that crazy old man with whooping cough who screamed at us to get off his property.
Turns out he was in the 1914 World Series champions.
Turns out he's a world-class athlete.
Herb Moran played later on with the, in the 20s, he played for and managed semi-pro teams in Pennsylvania and New York. and the Olean New Evening Herald in New York reported on a game between the Olean All-Stars and a team from Dansville, managed by Moran, who also played center field and was the leadoff hitter. Because, of course, if you manage a team, you have to play for them. And, quote, a feature of the game was the base running of Herb Moran, the old-timer. The old-timer is in quotes, because I guess that's his nickname. Herb burned his way over the path with a speed that would rival the fastest of younger ballplayers. The old-timer was 38 years old.
Wow, that was basically a death sentence in 1915.
Yeah, you were on your last legs.
I'm seeing that actually when Moran was acquired by the Braves from the Reds, their manager, Stallings, it says that he believed that with Moran in the outfield, there is no question as to what team will win the pennant. Which
he was right.
Bold take, but apparently he saw directly into the future.
Yeah. It won't be the last time someone looks directly into the future in this episode. I don't know how you're reading my
that
mind
is some
like this.
Eerie foreshadowing, but please continue.
So here's a description of Moran in his most famous moment in baseball. This is in the World Series when this is in Game 3. It's in extra innings. And while the Athletics were ahead, so this is against the Athletics, it is tied up in they score two in the top of the 10th. The Braves tie it in the bottom of the 10th. It's the 11th, it's the 12th, and we're in the last of the 12th right now. This is a New York Times reporter describing. The purple haze of eventide was gathering over Fenway Park, and the 35,520 persons who had sat for more than 3 hours were restless and fatigued as they looked down from all sides of the solid banks of humanity at the figures which moved about phantom-like in the twilight.
Did every writer die? Are all of the writers dead? I mean, we've discussed how going through old newspaper archives and old sports writers and everything, just everything had just a much more poetic, entertaining, engaging quality than
read
like
so much of this. Like, I would read like every recap.
It's like every recap is an American classic. Like it's unbelievable. It should be on a required reading list for every high schooler.
The solid banks of humanity is such a good description of a baseball crowd too. Like, it's so
yeah. I mean, there's certain terms that have caught on and been traditionally used to describe certain aspects of baseball throughout the years. You hear a phrase like that, and you're like, "Why did this not catch on?
That is
why did
exactly
we? Why did we get
what it is?
Yeah. Why did we get like fracas to describe every brawl? But this solid banks of humanity didn't. That one just didn't catch on. People
just
bothered,
wasn't.
I guess.
It's just not.
They
really
also had more time. I guess nowadays you're supposed to be clicking publish as soon as the last out is made. Where in this case, they're like, "All right, I got to really bust my ass to get this out by sunrise Tuesday."
Yeah, just like on their typewriter with cigarettes. They also could use amphetamines.
Yeah, my manager, my editor might think I'm dead. We haven't spoken in 6 days.
Whereas now my manager would think, or my editor would think I was fired if I didn't talk to him.
Yeah, and my editor is like, 20 years younger than me.
Oh, God. Gowdy led off with a double. Gowdy on the Braves. Leslie Mann came in to run for him. Larry Gilbert was walked intentionally. So two on and nobody is out. The situation called for a sacrifice bunt by Moran. Herbie's bunt went straight to the mound. Bush, the pitcher, picked up the ball and fired to third, trying to force Mann at the bag. The throw was wild and Mann dashed home with the winning tally. Moran had won the World Series for the Braves in a sacrifice bunt that led to the first walk-off error in World Series history.
Oh my God.
It's just brutal. The Times Scribe reported, "The crowd went wild. All the feeling and enthusiasm which had been bottled up as the game seesawed one way or then the other burst forth with unrestrained fury. The mob jammed down to the field and smothered the Boston players in a demonstration of fanatical joy which has rarely been seen at a baseball game."
Which has rarely been seen in a baseball game.
Good bird on baseball.
I have to add another Moran note.
In
late August 1914, a headline appeared in the Boston Globe that simply read, "Moran hitting 529.
Wow. Nothing more need be said at that point.
Well, I mean, yeah, they expand on it, but it's really just saying what the headline said, because again, what else is there to say other than to let your jaw drop?
Can you believe it?
For the last 4 days, he has been going at a wonderful pace, however, for making 7 hits and 10 bases in the recent cocked hat of games with the Giants. I got to tell you, I can't. We were just gushing over the prose of some of these columns. Other times, completely unreal.
Yeah, not so good that time.
written possibly by an illiterate.
The person just had a stroke and in the middle of it, like, recovered, looked at it and was like, I really don't want to rewrite this.
Yeah, you know what? It takes 8 hours to reset the machine that types this, so we're just going to roll with it.
This episode will go long. I hope that's okay with you, Justin. At this point, we're in our cups at this point, in our historical cups. So next, Joe Connolly, the left fielder for the Braves, he is the article written by Dennis Auger suggests that while people think about national pastime in Rhode Island during the dead ball era, while Napoleon Lajoie, Nap Lajoie, as we know him better, stands out as the premier sports personality, Joseph Connolly may have had a greater impact on the social, cultural, and baseball fabric of Rhode Island than any other player. I think that's a little unlikely.
That feels like a broad, sweeping statement that required, in his mind, zero fact-checking.
Yeah, that's a little rough. Like, I think there's probably not true. I think Nap Lajoie is probably more important. But he was good. Like, he out-hit Home Run Baker in the World Series. I'm sorry. Excuse me. This is actually much funnier than that happening. The manager of the Reds demonstrated his high regard for him by having him hit third in the lineup and betting several suits that he would out-hit Philadelphia's Home Run Baker in the series.
And openly gambling.
He did not do that, and so the manager owed a bunch of suits.
Dang it. I don't even own any suits.
This is really bad. He has a pretty interesting life after baseball, too. He was the founder and first president of the Sales Hill Rod and Gun Club. He was a Democrat who won election at town council and was a state representative and a state senator. And he was employed as an investigator by the Rhode Island State Board of Milk Control.
That's a critical role you play at that point, you know?
Well, you got to make sure the milk doesn't have, like, drugs in it or something.
Yeah, you never know which of those farmers was, like, waiting for you to get distracted so they could, like, sprinkle little illicit substances
in there.
Some arsenic
in there, those murderous farmers.
This will take down these children, these rowdy children down a peg in this farmland. You know, it's six farms over, which is to say several hundred miles away.
I hate them so much.
I hate the idea of them so much.
So on just a last minor note on Connolly, he died and in 43 he became suddenly ill, and the cause of death was listed as coronary disease. And a local headline in perhaps the least sensitive headline I've ever heard read, "Joey Connolly called out by great umpire."
that's terrific. Umpire shows great judgment in telling player he sucks.
No. You didn't understand what that was. Joey Connolly crawled out by great umpire, as in the great umpire in the sky.
Oh, God. Yeah, I did not understand that at all. Because why would you say it like that? Yeah. That's insane.
It's an amazing headline for a eulogy.
Wow. I mean, they really rolled the dice on that one. I'm assuming it paid off at the time that other people understood what that meant, or they literally went into that thinking, oh man, some excellent umpire must have called him out last night. And then, you know, sad twist.
Turns out this man just doesn't have any respect for death.
Oh no, he's dead. I see. And now to take a nice sip of my tall glass of milk.
After Joe Connolly, Sherry McGee was hitting, and he was in center field. Very good player. We talked about him earlier. I wanted to note one thing about his time with the Phillies that I think maybe made him a fan favorite. Sherry was enjoying another banner year in 1911, but his season and career were marred by his actions in the third inning of a game in St. Louis on July 10th. McGee came to bat with one out, and Dode Paskert, who's still on the team in 1915, on second, and Hans Lobert, I don't know who that is, on first. With two strikes, rookie umpire Bill Finneran called McGee out on what appeared to be a high pitch, prompting McGee to turn away in disgust and throw his bat high in the air.
That's where I've always put my bats when I was disgusted. You go live in the sky with the great umpire!
Justin Clue called out by great umpire.
But it's just a world-class umpire, like, telling me to get the hell out.
Bill Finneran yanked off his mask and threw him out of the game. Sherry, who had been heading to the bench, suddenly turned and attacked the umpire, clutching him for a second before hitting him with a quick left just above the jaw.
Before hurling him into the stratosphere where he was enveloped by the great
umpire. To the air with you!
You live with the bats now!
With blood spurting from his face, Finneran fell to the ground on his back, apparently unconscious.
Oh, this is upsetting.
The field umpire, Cy Regler, the Phillies manager, Red Doohan,
hey, bud,
was coaching first base, both rushed to the plate to assist Finneran. Meanwhile, Paskert and Lobert ran all the way around the bases, erroneously thinking that time had not been called, and McGee stood in front of the Phillies bench for a few seconds before several teammates led him under the stands. I love that Paskert and Lobert try to score at that point.
Now's our chance. The umpire's not looking. We gotta go. Meanwhile, the Red Doohan's out there like, huh, that's a funny looking color coming out of your face. I guess we ought to call you Red.
We could call you Brown.
Welcome to the club. Oh, you've stopped moving.
When he came to and realized what had happened, Finneran ripped off his chest protector and tried to reach the Philadelphia bench. Regler tried to hold him back, but only partly succeeded, his shirt becoming blood-covered in the process. Kitty Bransfield eventually intercepted Finneran and prevented him from reaching the bench. After he calmed down, Finneran went to the hospital for treatment with what was thought to be a broken nose. The Phillies won 4-2. After which McGee expressed regret for the incident, offering as an excuse that Finneran had called him a vile name. Doohan added that the rookie umpire had been too aggressive all season, get ready to laugh, often bragging about his ability as a fighter and threatening to lick players, including Doohan himself during a late June series in Boston.
Now keep in mind, in this era, lick was a threat of aggressive violence, something, you know, very badass to do. He wasn't necessarily, I mean, I don't want to speak for the man, but he wasn't necessarily threatening to run around with his tongue out to ward off any threatening players.
He might have been, you don't know.
But in either case,
not great
for an umpire to be doing.
So Finneran, McGee got actually suspended. He was originally suspended for the whole season, and then it was just till the end of June, which I think was like 21 games. And he was removed from Philadelphia because people didn't like him. He was very good, but he wasn't popular.
We can do that? We can. Why are we only learning this
Bobby
now?
Bobby Abreu, my friend. Bobby Abreu. They cheered his long swats, as all fans do, says a Philadelphia reporter, but shouted for his release. It was their generally held belief that he was, quote, a man who played for his own personal records and not for the good of the team.
Yeah, we hate those guys.
We don't like those guys.
we do a good job of making sure those types of guys don't come into our city, and it's only the team players and never the guys who are like, well, I'm just good at baseball. We like the guys who get along with you.
I like hitting 80 home runs. I hope it doesn't help my team.
Harmony is, I think, the unarguable common theme between every Phillies team from 1883 till today.
I will rush through the last four members of the Braves, then we'll go to break. But Butch Schmidt, who was the first baseman of this team, was a super interesting guy. He wasn't really well known for baseball. At the end of his life, he basically just started a meat market. And no one really knew that he was a star baseball player. And he just
feels like a lot of these guys craved anonymity after their playing career.
Yeah. I mean,
or it was just more available to them as an option in 1915.
I think maybe it's a little bit of both, but they definitely did. And so in the Boston Daily Globe, writing about the Braves and the A's, they said, Butch Schmidt of the Braves is the best first baseman in the game, until you see Stuffy McInnes, and Stuffy's the best, until you see Butch. Both are good enough to get by. They mean defensively, but that's a weird thing to say. And it says, in the Sabre bio, never was that comparison more apparent than the 1914 World Series. With one play, Schmidt opened many eyes and made his reputation. One scribe wrote that during practice before Game 1, McInnes made his bulky rival look foolish by his greater agility and accuracy. Moreover, they also disparaged Schmidt as, quote, a clumsy old cow. And with the lumbering Schmidt on first base, there was little doubt that the A's would have, quote, unlimited fun running the bases.
So you could just call a player a cow back then.
You could.
And come right back into the locker room the next day.
You could also be excited that they died and say they were called up called out of life, I guess, by the great umpire himself, God.
I think I'll take the obituary for this guy. I've got something special planned.
They really shouldn't have let his greatest enemy write the obituary.
Is it classy at least? Oh God, no.
No. Not classy even a little bit. So Baseball Magazine called it, this is the play that that Schmidt did. It was the first thrilling play of the first inning of the first game. It stunned the A's, gave them a wallop on the jump, but numbed their faculties. Frank Home Run Baker, lifted a foul pop-up in the first inning with runners on first and second to the edge of the bleachers in short right field. At full speed, Schmidt runs to the stands, reaches in, catches the ball, then wheels and fires across the diamond to get Eddie Murphy out at third base. No, not that Eddie Murphy.
Thank you for answering that question.
That double play ended the threat. Just making everyone laugh. And quote, then and there, something snapped in the heartstrings of Max Men. They never recovered.
Wow.
Yep, Connie Mack often credited Schmidt with that play that sparked the Braves to 4 straight upset.
That moment.
Yep.
I like knowing the moments when a team was broken, spiritually, mentally. Like obviously more than one moment goes into a team's like dramatic rise or dramatic fall. And I know for the 1964 Phillies, it's Chico Ruiz stealing home.
Yep.
That is credited as the moment when the Phillies' downfall began. But it's always good to know those moments because it's funny to think of like 25 adult men
being like,
simultaneously either exploding with motivation or dying inside together.
Oh, no.
Oh, that's it. I should not have invited all 13 of my kids to this game. Back to the silver mines with you, children.
I'm gonna skim over Red Smith, the third baseman for the Braves, to keep time in mind. But he's an interesting guy. He actually was really good. He hit 2,994 hits, which is pretty good. He almost made the 3,000 club.
That's okay.
it was in like minor league games. He's like a decent player, and there's not a lot of information on him other than his nickname comes from his red hair. But I will say, it's really, really sad. He was loyal to the Braves up until the end, and he lived in Atlanta. And he worked as an insurance agent. He lived in Atlanta for 35 years. And then the Milwaukee Braves moved to Atlanta in 1966. And his daughter said her father was the most enthusiastic booster the Braves had when they moved to Atlanta. Daddy maintained his interest in baseball through the years, but he was really excited when his Braves came here. Unfortunately, the Sabre bio says, Smith only had one season in which to cheer the Braves in his hometown. He died at the age of 76 on October 11th, 1966. Aortic insufficiency brought on by congestive heart failure.
And don't forget the concluding factor in his passing, the clouds above him forming the giant face of an enormous umpire whose fist and thumb indicated that he was out of there.
You're out. Rabbit Moranville is the next guy up. We know him. He's the shortstop for the Boston Braves at this point. There are so many stories about Rabbit Moranville. In 1914, he was part of that Braves team, and he won a game in August 6th, in the 10th inning. It was during their pennant drive, where basically every game was a playoff game. And he hit a home run in the 10th inning, even though he was suffering from a severe hangover for drinking too much champagne at a dinner party the night before.
I mean, you know, it just happens when you show up to work like that. You're like, we're celebrating. And everyone's like, that champagne was for everyone. And you're like, it doesn't matter.
Yikes. Well, I drank it all. In the clubhouse while I was undressing Stallings, the manager came over to me and said, this is Rabbit, you go back to choking up. You are no home run hitter. Rabbit remembered. Truthfully, I never did see the ball I hit, and years later, Babe Adams, who was the pitcher that day, asked me if it was a curve or a fastball I hit over the fence. I told him
I had just guzzled two entire bottles of champagne.
I told him I never saw it, and he said, I know darn well you never did. That's really good.
Wow, everyone hates that he hit that home run.
Yeah, except him. Also, apparently during the an exhibition game against the Yankees. Rabbit attempted to score even though the catcher was blocking the plate. And when the dust cleared, Moranville lay in agony, a bone jutting out of his ankle. "Out!" roared the umpire. Rabbit reportedly pointed to his limp foot resting on the edge of the plate and said, "You see where that foot is, don't you?" And then passed out.
So are we saying because of the way the compound fracture occurred, that his foot was bending at an angle that allowed him to unnaturally touch home
plate? That's right. He scored the run. And I want to read...
He's basically an Avenger. That's incredible.
I want to read his retirement speech. "For a quarter of a century, I've been playing baseball for pay. It has been pretty good pay most of the time. The work has been hard, but what of it? It's been risky. I've broken both my legs. I sprained everything I got between my ankles and my disposition. I've dislocated my joints and fractured my pride. I spent more time in hospitals than some fellows ever spend in church. I've ridden on railroad trains until a steam shovel couldn't lift the cinders I've combed out of my hair. I've eaten lousy food and slept on lousy beds. I've been socked with fists and pop bottles and insults. I've been awakened out of bed in the middle of the night by fat-headed bums who only wanted to know what Pop Anson's all-time batting average was. I've lost a lot of teeth and square yards of hide, but I never lost my self-respect, and I've kept what I find in few men of my age, my enthusiasm."
Oh my God, I want to get that framed. That's unbelievable. Even the obituaries were better written back then.
So good.
Wow. I got to be honest, when you said I've sprained everything from my ankle to my discipline, I thought something else was coming.
Oh, yeah. No, I thought so too when I read that. I was like, my ankle to what? But I think he's implying it. Next is...
Brilliantly written.
Oh, just incredible. Next is Hank Gowdy, who was the catcher. Hank Gowdy, most famous for being the first baseball player to enlist in World War I. Not a great choice, but hey, good for him.
Hey, respect, but that's a great way to, you know what I'm about to go with, get called out by a certain umpire who lives above us.
He carried the colors for the Fighting 42nd literally in the Western Front. In the trench warfare on the Western Front against the Germans in World War I, maybe the most horrible place to be of all time.
Yeah. Wow.
He actually turned down an offer of $1,500 a week for 30 weeks to tour the country and return to the Braves to play baseball again. He was fine. He did a good job. He was involved in what one reporter called the most remarkable double play ever seen in Boston, with the bases loaded and one out. Brooklyn catcher Rowdy Elliott tapped back to Oshker, who was the pitcher, who actually shows up in this game, I think, and who fired to Gowdy to force Zach Wheat, not a real person, at the plate. But Gowdy's throw to first base was low, and Walter Hulk bobbled it. Big Ed Konecny, running from second, tried to score on the fumble. Hulkie's return throw was off to Gowdy's right. He reached for it, grabbed it, then threw himself blindly against the plate to meet Konecny's spikes with bare fist. A vivid snapshot of the dead ball game.
Wow. Yeah, you know, I certainly don't advocate for, you know, the baseball was better in my day angle that anyone takes from any era. Like, anybody who grew up watching baseball thinks that the era they grew up watching is the best era of all time. However, having learned the many details of the dead ball era, I got to tell you, it at the very least, you can say it makes for a lot more thrilling narratives.
It is.
It's definitely closer to like adventure novels than baseball recaps.
Yeah, it feels like a totally unregulated chaos. It is really good. I'm going to leave you. This is the Boston Braves, and we'll go to break. This is the Boston Braves pitcher on the day, Tom Hughes. Tom Hughes is kind of an interesting character. He went by Salida Tom. I don't know why. I think because he's from Salida.
Okay. That would make sense.
Let's see. Why is he Salida Tom? I think it's because he's from Salida. They don't actually give a good reason that I can see why his name is that. There's a guy named Long Tom Hughes, who was also a big deal player at that point, so it got kind of confused. He was described as an old Salida boy at his wedding, That's why he became Salida Tom. So Hughes' days of professional baseball, he played quite a while. They thought they were over in 1918. The newspaper... Oh, this is later. In 1919, he got he got offered a tryout in the PCL. It was successful. He was back in baseball. He was released by the Braves. He believed he had overcome, quote, a cold in his arm, which caused his release from the Braves. Not a thing.
Boy, doctors really sucked back then. Please continue.
Really, really bad. So he's like, I think I got a cold in my arm, Doc's like, yeah, that can happen.
Sounds good enough to me. That'll be 13 cents. Hey, pass me that jug with a bunch of X's on it, will you?
And so he pitched shutout ball in his start against the Vernon Tigers, and then his arm went dead in dramatic fashion. And I knew you'd like this. I was going to cut it, but then after our discussion of newspaper writing, I knew I couldn't. The Times wrote, Harry Williams wrote, 2 months of faithful preparation, more months of careful nursing of the old wing to bring it back to life went for naught. And the hope of all this was shattered when the arm dropped limp at his side. Tom Hughes had failed to come back.
Oh, man. The only thing grimmer would be describing the manager's face as he lugged an old shotgun out to the pitching mound to deal with his pitcher.
Send him to the great umpires.
Get on your knees.
Soon after, the New York Times reported that Hughes had quit for good after, quote, one disastrous trial on the mound. And the LA Times reported he was a used car salesman now. But in fact, in 1920, he asked Powers for another tryout, and he was successful. He made an effective comeback and pitched for 7 more years. Here's the description. Unlike the dark description of his setback the year before, Hughes' effort was described in colorful euphemisms of 20th century sports reporting. And above all, the hectic disturbance, glimmering like a comet at midnight, shone the name of Tom Hughes, whose rejuvenation as a pitcher is undoubtedly the most phenomenal comeback in the history of the game.
I need to be a better writer. I need to learn how to do this better. I thought I was okay before, but I got to tell you, I got to do some work.
And we will come back also, although not as good as Tom Hughes, after this message. Justin, are we back?
Oh, it sounds like we are back.
We're back.
Yes,
okay,
I've finished running in circles around my house, and I am back, and yes, we can continue.
Great, good. Well, now we're heading into the Phillies. I know we're running long, but I hope you're enjoying all these stories. I didn't tell you the sad story of Pat Moran. Let's start with that. Pat Moran died before he could really become famous. I told you he pitched with he managed the Reds, and he managed them to the 1919 World Series, or 1917 World Series, excuse me. Managed through 1919, was actually set to manage them from then on. He never got fired. Unfortunately, he had always been a heavy drinker, and over the winter of 1923 to 1924, his drinking worsened. He began skipping meals. He was quite ill when he arrived in Orlando for spring training, and he died on March 7th at 48. Bright's disease was the kidney ailment. I looked up Bright's disease, and it is described as this. It's a historical classification of kidney diseases. I don't really know much about it, but one of the things you're not supposed to do when you have Bright's disease is you're supposed to not drink alcohol.
You're not supposed to guzzle alcohol and let it replace food.
Abstinence from alcoholic drinks, cheese, and red meat. So all the things that you can get at a baseball park. So
perfect.
Very sad. Just,
what am I supposed to do? Eat handfuls of dust? Screw this.
The shame of it is, I mean, he was a really, really good manager. He probably would have been a Hall of Fame manager, but he passed away at 48, and he's not really as well known as that. He is not as bad off as some of the people in this. Some of the people on this team, not very well known. One guy that is, I mean, he has a decent Saber bio by Mr. Irv Goldfarb, is Bobby Byrne, who was the third baseman of the Phillies. Byrne was most famous. He did okay. I mean, he wasn't bad for the Phillies in 14 and 15. But he was most famous in 1909. He was playing in the World Series. He was hit in the shoulder by a pitch to lead off Game 7, and he reached second on a sacrifice, but was thrown out trying to steal third. Quote, I broke my ankle sliding into George Moriarty at third base and spiked the Tiger third sacker so badly that 8 stitches were required to close a gash in his knee, Byrne recalled years later. It all happened in the first inning, and probably was the only time in series history that the regular third sackers of the rival clubs were carried off the field on stretchers. Burns' recollection wasn't quite accurate. Moriarty stayed in the game long enough to double in the second inning before giving way to a pinch runner, obviously. Contemporary coverage of the incident wasn't kind to the Pirate cornerman. Quote, Byrne and Moriarty were injured when Bobby made a needless attempt to steal third in a game in which Wild Bill Donovan, the Detroit pitcher, showed nothing, wrote one reporter. The Pirates won the game without Byrne, who received a big ovation when he showed up on crutches for the next day's victory celebration at Forbes Field.
This is starting at shortstop.
his leg is just... It is amazing that he got the Tiger third baseman got an injury that would probably keep you out 2 months in today's game. It was like, I'm going to hit a double the next inning.
Like, why couldn't you break your foot in the way that that guy did to score, like in that other baseball game that happened?
I just have a poster of Rabbit Moranville on my wall, and it's his ankle broken.
Yeah, just the base. Dangling, just protruding bone.
Smiling and putting his thumbs up before he passes out from blood loss. playing at short was actually Dave Bancroft. We talked a little bit about him. We know that why he was famous with the Phillies. He was a very good player. And
he's, unlike the rest of these men, famous for being good at baseball while on the Phillies.
He was traded. And basically he was traded because Baker got an offer. Baker was, William Baker, the president of the Phillies, was selling everyone. And in 1920, the Giants owner, Charles Stoneham, called Baker and offered shortstop Art Fletcher, pitcher Wilbur Hubbell, and now remember when you hear this number that $8,000 was 6 years earlier considered an enormous amount of money for a salary. Offered $100,000 for Bancroft.
Wow.
An incredulous Baker took the first train to New York the next morning and consummated the deal, bringing along the National League attorney as a witness lest Stoneham try to back out.
I mean, yeah, I wouldn't be taking any precautions, or I'd be taking every precaution at that point, too. Quick note on Bancroft. Did you know that according to a 1950 edition of the Philadelphia Inquirer, he actually had managed the South Bend girls team in the All-American Girls Baseball League from a league of their own?
I love that. That's cool. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that was the same team. That's very neat. He's a super interesting guy. When he took the field in his first game as a Giant, the catcher called him to the mound and offered to explain the team's sides, and he said, quote, why? Have they changed? If not, I know them already. Which rocks.
I do have an affinity for old school pitchers who, when they see the catcher coming, they're just like Bob Gibson, give him the old, like, get the hell back behind the plate. Like, I don't want to talk to you. This is not a social event. This is not a gala. Get on your knees before the manager, like, comes back out here with the shotgun and sends us both to the great umpire in the sky.
Everyone's crossing their fingers against the great umpire in the sky. Oh, the great umpire. Great umpire. He also his nickname is Beauty, and the reason is because every time in the minors that he would see a good pitch to hit, he would say Beauty and then hit it.
Okay, that's asking to get smacked, frankly, in that dugout.
It also rocks.
Shut up.
It knows.
Beauty
crack. He also in June of 1923, reported to the Polo Grounds with a high fever, played 9 innings, and then collapsed in the clubhouse. He had a severe case of pneumonia, which earned him admiration from his manager.
Yeah, I mean, this was a golden era for people who really respected players for playing near death.
Yeah.
Or with bones outside of their bodies.
And at 33, he became a manager, so he had a pretty cool career.
Yeah.
And he lived to be inducted into the Hall of Fame, which is cool.
Beauty.
Yeah. Beauty. Crack. Beals Becker is the next player on our list, and he was, Beals Becker played left field in this game. He had one of the home runs. He had one of the two runs in this game, so good for him. There's no information on him, really. But I will say this, on episode 1309 of PBS's Antiques Roadshow, a man who claimed to be Becker's great-great-nephew brought two photographs and a uniform belonging to the show for appraisal. The items were valued at $50,000 US dollars.
All right. Do we believe that it was really him? That it was this guy's grandson?
I choose to believe that, yes.
I mean, what a weird lie, if not.
Yeah, no, definitely. The next guy up is the guy that I want to talk about a lot more, so I'll wait. That's Gavi Cravath. And I will get to Gavi Cravath. Don't you worry. I had to start a whole Word document for Gavi Cravath. We will end the show on him. After Gavi, though, is Possum Witted, who we talked about a little bit before, but Possum is a fantastic guy. Just a weird dude. Had a quartet. So if you don't remember, there's a quartet. Next up in the Phillies lineup was Bert Niehoff at second base. Now Bert, when he went into the World Series, unfortunately, second base was considered a very, very strong position for the Red Sox. The Phillies were a clear underdog to the Red Sox. One of the positions where Boston was given a decided edge was second base, where syndicated sports columnist and noted World Series prognosticator, I told you prognostication would come back, Hugh Fullerton summed up the situation thusly, quote, "Perhaps no comparison between players on the rival teams shows more superiority one over the other than does Red Sox Jack Berry over Niehoff. It is the wily, foxy veteran, hardened in hundreds of battles, brainy, and a born leader, against an ordinary ball player without great experience, who is hustling, doing just the best he can, and improving."
Wow, what a needless burn. I'm gonna use my space in the newspaper to just really come down on this guy who even I will have to say is doing his best.
Just ruin this guy. Although the slick fielding Berry was not much of a hitter, Fullerton figured him to be, quote, much better than that in the series, particularly compared with Niehoff, who the scribe predicted would not bat 150 against the Red Sox staff of Smokey Joe Wood, Babe Ruth, Ernie Shore, and Dutch Leonard. A week later, Niehoff made Fullerton a profit. He batted a dismal .63 with 5 strikeouts as Boston took the World Series handily in 5 games. Not great.
I think that's a fair summation. We can wrap that up with a not great.
the final note in his Sabre bio is, "Endowed with only limited playing ability, but infused with a passion for baseball, Bert Niehoff devoted virtually his entire 60-year working life to the game, being one of that legion of unsung men who helped sustain the sport through the better part of the 20th century." It's just mean.
Amen. Yeah, I mean,
just mean.
He did his best and still sucks.
He has limited. You could say I have limited playing ability. I don't think you should say it about that guy.
Like, what are you gaining from this? just every newspaper man just decided, like, this guy's not worth the ink, frankly.
Yeah.
And we're going to burn him every chance we can get.
It's really mean. Like, it's just rough. Fred Luteris is up next. He's the first baseman. He was a home run hitter. Like, he was a home run hitter in a year where in an era where home runs were not the thing that you were to hit. He reached double digits in home runs from 1911 to 1914. It was helpful that the Baker's box was, quote, a cigar box, called by out-of-town sports writers. You may remember band box, but I think cigar box should be the thing we call it.
Well, it's easier to, you know, visualize in your head what a cigar box is. Yeah. I have a hard time recalling. Yeah, a band box. You
would
know,
it fit
that
in
everyday
a band
reference
box?
In 2019.
I do think that. The other thing is that apparently Luteris played 479 consecutive games and broke the modern record in 1916, which was set the year earlier by Eddie Collins of the White Sox. His streak almost ended earlier because he was suffering from a Charlie horse, but baseball record keeper Al Monroe Elias of the Elias Sports Bureau was at the ballpark that day and pleaded with the manager to get Luteris into the game. Coombs sent Fred into pitch and the streak survived.
That's what you want in the middle of a streak. One of your colleagues to have to beg the manager to put you in the game.
Not even your colleagues, it's just a records keeper.
please, sir, get out of here, Earl.
No. It actually went to 533 games, which is impressive. He unfortunately had to retire because of lumbago. Don't laugh. He also, on the 527th and 528th games of the streak, the Phillies honored him with Fred Luteris Day, presenting him with a gold watch and diamond stick pin between games of a doubleheader.
Ah, yes, the stick pin. characterizing baseball's highest achievements by, I assume, having it stuck into your chest somehow.
I pulled up Ed Burns, not because we need to talk about him, because we did talk about him before, but because I am so impressed you found any information on this man for the Bill Kilifer episode. There's nothing. You're much better at this than I am, because there is nothing on him.
It's all about being determined to find one little piece of information before giving up, I gotta tell you.
Blown away. Like, there's nothing
for some of these guys.
Yeah.
You really got to tunnel into the shit.
Well, and I know about him, because you're like, I'm looking, I'm like, St. Louis Cardinals. Oh, yeah, this was the guy that was a good hitter, but, like, was hurt a lot. Like, it's just... Is he like Bill Kilifer? He's a little like... Yeah, no, it's amazing to me. So, good job, Justin. Everyone should appreciate Justin. Next up, we have our friend, present friend, the pitcher, Erskine Meyer. I wanted to read about Erskine Meyer's life, because his baseball career was fine, but not that great, and this game was no good. But his life...
was good
something. The article was written, so this is, it's not bad, I'll say that. It's crazy. This is by Lyle Spatz at Sabre. Erskine Meyer had a most interesting background, one that was very different from that of most players in the early 20th century. Meyer's paternal grandparents were Jews who came from Germany. His great-grandfather, his grandmother's father, had been a buyer for Otto von Bismarck, the Prussian statesman who unified Germany.
Yeah. I was going to say, is that
Otto von Bismarck? He disappeared one day, his great-grandfather, and it wasn't until years later that his body was discovered buried in a stable. Both of his grandparents were musicians, a talent they passed on to Erskine's father, Isaac, who composed an opera written in Hebrew. That lineage was poles apart from Meyer's family on his mother's side. His mother, born Henrietta Frankel, traced her ancestry back to the Mayflower. Her family owned tracts of land in what was then Virginia Territory and today is the state of Kentucky. His maternal grandmother's brother, James Allen, captained a riverboat that ran from Hannibal, Missouri to New Orleans. It was from Marking Twain on Captain Allen's boat that young Samuel Clemens chose the nom de plume of Mark Twain.
All righty. Quite a few historical figures on this journey.
Yeah. Meyer's maternal grandmother had converted to Judaism and both of his parents were raised in the Jewish religion. So... Yeah, Mark Twain is involved with this guy. Otto von Bismarck, a murder? It's no wonder that his baseball career was outshone.
Yeah, long and winding road through American history to get to this point.
I will say that Meyer was not overpowering on the mound, but as the Sabre bio says, he had good speed but relied more on good control and excellent sidearm curveball, a pitch that led Brooklyn manager Wilbert Robinson to call Meyer Eelskine instead of Erskine because the pitch was, quote, slow, slippery. It was also Robinson who said that you could upset the Atlanta-born Meyer by whistling Marching Through Georgia or writing him about the South.
I do think there was a guy who also was easily roused by whistling a particular song.
Yeah.
That was a common trait back then.
It's great. Next up is Dode Paskert. He pinch hit. We don't have to talk much about Dode except to remind our listeners that we have an episode that features him, and his nickname is the only thing that people can understand is maybe it was Dode because... Dode means a slow-witted person, and a spattering of press accounts confirmed that Paskert was considered stupid.
Something that they bothered to cover in the press at this time.
Certain critics, W.A. Phelan of Baseball Magazine writes, declare that there is no choice between Bates and Paskert when it comes to intelligence. Both of them are crowned with domes of elephant tusk, and that if either of them ever thought quickly, it must have been when deciding whether to take beer or ginger ale.
Who's the dumbest player in baseball right now? See, we don't know because the press doesn't cover.
Ty Wigginton would have had he would have had the title for a while, right?
I think it's Trevor Bauer.
No. I mean he's a bad person, but I don't know. Like, do you think he has traditional intelligence?
I think that he's good at the illusion of intelligence. I think he's good at setting up the facade. Like, oh, look, I play with drums.
Okay.
Oh, look, I know about, like, drag and, like, the physics of pitching. But, like, if you sat him down, he would give you the same, like, rehearsed points that he got off of, like, some website. I don't think he actually, like, you can spout off all the facts you want, but the way you conduct yourself kind of indicates that, like, oh, you're operating on this level below the average person.
Okay.
And I just, you see that every time he speaks.
I buy it. Trevor Bauer is the Dode Paskert of the modern day. Finally, we have our relief pitcher, Joe Oshker, who I said I mentioned before he would come back. He played for, he played in a dozen major league seasons. He was on a bunch of teams. He's most known. He's not an important pitcher or anything, but he is most known for pitching two games of 20 plus innings. So, on May 1st, 1920, he was on the Braves and they were playing the Brooklyn Robins, and he and the opposing pitcher Leon Cador played all 26 innings of that game.
And that's why they're dead.
It was a game. It's famous for being halted by darkness. It's still the longest game in Major League history. But it lasted 3 hours and 50 minutes. And Oshker allowed 9 hits over 26 frames, which is nuts.
That is, I can see why they left him in. but also, you got to be at a certain point accepting that this man is going to die.
Well, then, a year earlier than that, when he was still with the Phillies, and they were playing the Robins again, he and Brooklyn spitballer Burley Grimes both pitched 20 innings. And the score was tied 6-6 after 9 innings, and then they threw goose eggs until the 19th frame, when each club scored 3 runs. Umpires stopped the game on account of darkness after the 20th inning.
Good for them. Jeez. Honestly. Awful. I hope it was broad daylight when they called it on account of darkness. I would have done the same
thing. We're done. I'm going to leave Bill Killifer, who was the catcher for this game, for people. If people want to find it, it's on the Patreon. It is the Christmas episode. But Justin, I want to end tonight by talking to you about my new favorite baseball player, Gavi Kerrath. Gavi Kerrath.
It's always good to come out of an episode with a new favorite player, so I assume this
will
is
be good.
Only the...
This is great. He was an anomaly in the dead ball era. This is from his Saber bio, which is amazing. It is a great Saber bio. It's by Bill Swank. It is excellent. All credit in the world to Bill Swank for this one. He employed a powerful swing, and he led the National League in home runs 6 times. He actually held the record briefly for most home runs in a season and career. And Kravath bucked the trend in pre-sweaty practice. Short singles are like left-hand jabs in the boxing ring, but a home run is a knockout punch, he asserted. It is the cleanup man of the club that does the heavy scoring work, even if he is wide in the shoulders and slow on his feet. There is no advice I can give in batting except to hammer the ball. Some players steal bases with hook slides and speed. I steal bases with my bat.
I'm sorry, did he write a manifesto, or is this just an example of what somebody would tell a reporter after a game in 1915?
I think he must, I mean, I would say it's the latter, but there is so much good Kerrath quotes.
Oh, that's the good Kerrath.
It was during his semi-pro days that he gained the nickname Gavi. There are many stories about its origin, but it's apparently a contraction for the Spanish word gaviota, which means seagull. During a Sunday game in the early 1900s, Kerrath reportedly hit a ball so hard that it killed a seagull in flight. Mexican fans shouted, "Gaviota!" The English-speaking fans thought it was a cheer, and the name stuck.
Holy Lord. How did they figure out what had happened fast enough to do a cheer about it?
I don't know. I don't care if it's not real. It's real to me now.
Somehow we are horrifyingly privy to what it looks like when a bird is killed by a live ball.
When a bird just explodes.
I can't imagine this was that different from that, and how they didn't just assume, oh, it's the end times. The birds are popping like popcorn kernels. It's the end
Mexican,
times. We're close
the
enough.
The Mexican fans
to the Bible.
Probably just saw the seagull explode and yelled seagull because that is horrifying. Everyone's
That's
like,
true,
hooray!
Yeah.
Not fitting into the mode of the stereotypical dead ball era fly chaser, Cravath had difficulty breaking into a Boston outfield, which we actually talked about before, including Tris Speaker and Harry Hooper. He remained sensitive about his relative lack of speed. Quote, "They call me wooden shoes and piano legs and a few other pet names."
Yeah, pet names. Okay, that's not what the insults is what they are.
I do not.
They call me old piano legs. Get in there. It's just a loving.
They're
pet
calling
name.
Me big moron, and I'm sick of this nickname. It's nice, but I don't like it.
Get in there, piano legs. Get in there, you stupid dipshit. I love you too, guys.
Hey, my friends. I do not claim to be the fastest man in the world, but I can get around the bases with a fair wind and all sails set, and so long as I am busting the old apple on the seam, I am not worrying a great deal about my legs. He was sold to the Chicago White Sox when he only had a single home run but 11 triples in 1909. A slow start in the Windy City got him traded to the lowly Washington Senators for Sleepy Bill Burns, a promising but corrupt pitcher who had posted a 1.70 ERA as a rookie in 1908.
I wonder what that means.
I don't know.
Probably a corrupt police chief in the
offseason. I clicked his Sabre bio just now. I don't know what Bill Burns did that he was corrupt. He was egocentric, lackadaisical, and difficult to manage. Oh, and he was involved in the Black Sox scandal and turned state's evidence.
We are stupid for not suggesting that initially.
Yeah, he was traded to the White Sox and was corrupt. I guess
that. What would that mean? Guess he was a corrupt police chief.
I agreed with you. That's the worst part.
It's a baseball podcast.
When he was in minor leagues, he was stuck in the minor leagues with the Minneapolis Millers for a while. He hit 29 home runs in his season. It was the most ever recorded in organized baseball at that time. And at one point in the season, his manager threatened to fine Gavvy $50 if he hit any more home runs over the right field barrier. Apparently, he'd broken the same window in a Nicollet Avenue haberdashery three times during a single week.
Stop hitting so many home runs. You are destroying the stadium. What a time to be playing
baseball.
You
are breaking this hat owner's, you're breaking this hat store's window. Stop it.
If you break one more window, this professional baseball franchise will literally go out of
business. We cannot afford another window. I will take the $50 out of your hide.
Glass is at a premium right now. We're using glass to fight the Germans and my friend Otto von Bismarck.
Erskine? But despite his impressive numbers, Cravath couldn't escape the minors, a victim of the dead ball era's draft rules, which we really should learn more about at some point. Man. I mean, who does know anything about them? But it's interesting. You'll like this, though. This is a good story. It took a clerical error. The Minneapolis Millers inadvertently left out the word "not" in a telegram to Pittsburgh.
Come on, guys.
To get Gavvy back to the big leagues. In a controversial decision, the National Commission ruled that Minneapolis could not retain Cravath because of the mistake.
Wow.
Yep.
What a catty move. They must have really pissed them
it
off.
It rocked so much. They just, like, I just like imagining him seeing the telegram and seeing, like, it says, Cravath is allowed to leave the team, and, like, realizing that they just struck out the word "not." He's like, oh, yeah, this looks fine to me.
I could see Rob Manfred doing this kind of thing. No, it was a typo. So, that's just
he's
it.
A free agent.
There's
now.
Nothing I can do. My hands are tied.
It rocks so much. So the Phillies purchased him for $9,000, and he was really good. He had good defense. He had good power. He had good batting average. It was really solid. He became manager of the Phillies in 1919. Reluctantly, it says, because they were bad at that point. And
they've all done it reluctantly. Because nobody's walked in there with a smile on their face. Every single one of them has joined reluctantly.
They were 18 and 44 when he got hired, and at the end of his time, they were 29 and 75. But he was invited to return to the helm because who else wanted the job? And they won a little bit more. He also played. He led the NL with 12 pinch hits in his second year managing. They finished with 62-90 that year, a little better. There was a controversy, though. It was actually a grand jury investigation into an allegedly fixed late-season game in which the Phillies whitewashed the Cubs 3-0. And a sports writer asked them about it, and Cravath replied, "This is the best Phillies quote I maybe have ever heard." I don't know why they got to bring up a thing like this just because we win one. We're liable to win a game anytime. So good.
That's a fair point, I guess. But at the same time,
And I'm going to leave you with the story of his later life, which is so good. Gavi Cravath managed the Salt Lake City Bees of the Pacific Coast League in 21, then spent 1 year as a scout for the Minneapolis Millers, his last job in professional baseball. Returning to Laguna Beach, California, where for years he'd leisurely enjoyed his off seasons fishing the Pacific and accumulating property, he became active.
Interesting.
This is mine now.
Just standing on a beach.
This is a beach, sir. It's my beach. It's Cravath Beach. And I'll kill this seagull to prove it.
Hand me that bat. Just throws it, lands in the ocean. Damn it.
I wish I had a ball.
If I had another ball, I'd kill you.
Do you have another ball? If I did, I wouldn't give it
your head
to you.
Like a, pop your head like a seagull.
One of the players, I actually forgot to mention this, with one of the players, they were hit in the head and got a concussion and came back the next day to play baseball.
That's the best time to come back from a concussion.
Just so you know about how people's heads were when hit by baseballs in this era.
Sure. Your head can operate, Trev, at full capacity when half full of blood. So I don't want to hear any complaints out of anybody about whatever it is we were talking about.
He was active in the real estate business, and in September 27, Cravath was elected judge. And for the rest of his life, enjoyed saying that he claimed a gavel quite by accident. He and two friends didn't like the sitting judge in Laguna Beach, so they drew straws to determine which of the three would run against him. Gavi drew the short straw and won the election by an almost 3-to-1 ratio. Lacking any formal legal training, he claimed that he based his decisions on principles of sportsmanship. Sorry. He'd learned on the diamond. He's baseball judge.
So we've just never really gotten it right as a society.
Baseball judge, you're out.
I feel like when you can just pull literal sitcom ideas right out of history with little to no alteration to the facts, we've made some mistakes along the way. That's indicative of that.
You're out of here, baseball judge.
Baseball judge, we'll be right back after this.
It's so good. Now, I may not have any formal legal training, but I did spend many years in the baseball diamond. And I know when you're out, you're out.
I'm no famous big city umpire, but I know an out when I see it.
Isn't that right, great umpire in the sky? That's right.
You're crushing this.
You live in a world of horrible illusions. Just nightmares. Judge Cravath, I hear you asking, are there stories about Judge Cravath? Good news, there are. He became known as a crusty jurist, and stories abound from his years on the bench. Once, when two young robbers appeared before him and asked permission to join the armed forces as part of a probation sentence, Cravath said, quote, "When I see a man in uniform walking down the street, I look at him with pride. You haven't earned the right to wear such a uniform bearing the honor of our country. 6 months in county jail." On another occasion, Cravath asked a Santa Ana motorcycle cop, this is a really good story, if he was heading back to the station after a hearing. The officer replied in the affirmative. Next, the town drunk staggered into the courtroom and Cravath said, "Pete, you hop on the back of George's bike and he'll take you up to the county jail for a few days to dry out." No stranger to due process, Pete objected. "You can't do that, Gavi. Hell, I ain't even been arraigned yet." Cravath glared at the drunk. "Now look here, Pete," he growled. "You know you were drunk, and I know you were drunk. Now, we're not going to waste any of the taxpayers' money at a goddamn trial. Get on that goddamn motorcycle and go to jail for a few days to dry out." Pete grinned sheepishly and obeyed the order.
Can we rewind? There was a line there that I wanted to highlight.
Please.
That's basically the center of the
Please
story.
Please go on.
But I do need your help, your motivation here. What does he say? We're not going to waste the taxpayers' money with a trial.
On a goddamn trial.
Yeah, that's okay. That's kind of what you need to know.
It rocks so much. I love the last line where it's "get on that motorcycle and go to jail," and Pete grins sheepishly and obeys.
Okay. All right.
It's like Andy Griffith, but a little more for the adult crowd.
He like grabs the deputy like around the waist when he gets on the back of the motorcycle.
Well-known and widely respected, Judge Cravath was reversed only twice during his 36-year tenure on the bench. When he finally died at 82, few Laguna Beach residents even realized that in a prior life, the Honorable Clifford C. Cravath had set Major League home run records of 119 home runs that were was quickly eclipsed by Babe Ruth, that it took the mighty Babe Ruth to break. The wow. end.
And people just didn't know that when he was sending them to jail without a trial.
Hey, you can't send me to jail. There hasn't been a trial. Now shut up already.
Yeah, shut up. We're doing it. And everyone here will agree to
you
it.
You moron. Get off to jail. All right.
I know my rights. I know my rights. You cannot do this. Well, I'm doing it. Okay, fine.
I won't make a stink.
Well, an excellent
interview. Yeah, I'm sorry Jeff. It did go long, Justin, but I hope you'll agree that it was worth it.
Well, it's not just me you're talking to, Trev. It's a whole audience.
I hope you all
people,
will agree it's worth it.
So I apologize to everyone. We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Dirty Inning, which is, like I said, a podcast where we investigate the dumbest, most forgotten, or most obscure innings in Phillies history. If you want to, you should feel free to subscribe, download, and rate all the Good Fight Family podcasts like Hittin' Season, like Continued Success, and like The Dirty Inning. You can also find bonus content for all of these podcasts on Patreon, patreon.com/hittin'season, for all sorts of extended episodes. John Stolness does a lot of series previews, baseball card stuff, all that crap.
Sounds so good.
And it's just $5. So feel free to go over there and give us $5 of your dollars. But again, thank you for listening to The Dirty Inning, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye-bye.